Good evening and welcome behind the news for March 20, 2008. This is Dyke Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Got two segments lined up for tonight. First, we'll be joined in a few minutes in the studio by Jim Ledbetter, who just edited a collection of Marx's journalism. Even people who've read a lot of Marx probably haven't read a lot of his journalism. I bet some people don't even know that he was a journalist. So we'll talk about that and what he covered and how his journalism compares to the practice of that noble art today. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll be joined by a frequent guest of this show, Naomi Prinz, who was formerly an employee of Bear Stearns, a firm that went poof earlier this week. And wow, how about that Bear Stearns deal? I should say at first that I'm talking about the acquisition of the 85-year-old investment bank Bear Stearns by J.P. Morgan Chase, with the assistance and probably the insistence of the Federal Reserve. So, was it necessary, and what does it mean? To answer the first question with a question of sorts depends upon what you mean by necessary. If you're a free marketeer, your answer is no. Let failure take its course and everything will work out in the long run. It was in a very similar context that Keynes made his famous remark about our all being dead in the long run. Some radical leftists seem to agree, let the whole rotten system come crashing down and then we can rebuild it. The problem with the first point of view is that in the long run could turn out to be a very long time indeed, a decade or more. And the problem with the second one is that there's not much of a we to do the rebuilding, and even if there were, there's no guarantee that they would call on us to do it. But if you think that the risk of throwing millions out of work to make a political point aren't worth it, then some sort of bailout of Bear was necessary. The firm wasn't all that big, and the past tense is probably warranted, because it's likely to be absorbed by J.P. Morgan Chase and disappear without much of a trace. But it was connected to scores of other institutions like banks and hedge funds. If Bear had got under, it would have left those so-called counterparties holding an empty bag, and many would have probably followed Bear down the drain, and they could have dragged others down the drain with them. Aside from that direct effect, the blow to confidence would have been enormous, and without confidence, the financial markets just cannot operate. If Bank A doesn't trust Bank B as being good for the money, then it's not going to trade with it. If that were to spread, that would mean a freeze-up of normal business and consumer lending that would quickly throw the real economy into the tank. J.P. Morgan Chase is paying a notional $2 a share for Bear Stearns, a 30th of what it was just a few days earlier. J.P. Morgan is also assuming the risk for some of Bear's crappier assets, which could turn out to be worthless or close to it. The Fed is offering Morgan a $30 billion guarantee against the worst, which may or may not ever be needed. In any case, so far the Fed has made mostly promises that have not yet been called on, so there hasn't been any significant expenditure of actual public funds in this bailout or during any of the extraordinary measures that have preceded it in recent months. The Fed is one of those rare creatures that can print money out of thin air without getting arrested for it. It doesn't get any appropriations from Congress out of the federal budget. It's self-financing mainly because it buys treasury bonds with that money that it creates and then collects the interest payments on them. It deducts whatever it wants for expenses and passes along what remains as profit, about $25 billion a year recently, to the U.S. Treasury. But it's also extremely unlikely that this crisis will be resolved without the expenditure of real taxpayer money and probably large gobs of it. Resolving the savings and loan crisis of the 1980s took about $200 billion of federal money. Amazingly, no one really knows exactly how much. The equivalent today would be $400 to $500 billion. In the early 1990s, Sweden spent about 2% of its GDP resolving a very similar financial crisis to what we're going through today. The U.S. equivalent of that amount would be close to $300 billion. Since the expenditure of public funds is probably inevitable, it would be very nice if the public actually got something in return, though the precedents for that are not very encouraging. At the very least, the financial system needs badly to be re-regulated to prevent the sort of wild speculative adventures that have become routine in recent decades. The Wall Street types will complain that this will hurt them badly or assert that regulation is impossible because everything is just too complicated these days. These claims should be studiously ignored. This whole boom-bust bailout cycle has gotten very wasteful and very dangerous. It would have been nice if the dot-com and Enron debacles had led to some sort of re-regulation, but they didn't. This time around, the hangover was likely to be even worse than the last go-around. What might the next one look like without some sort of re-regulation? Fortunately, some people in Washington are starting to talk about this, but without serious popular pressure, the measures would likely be very indulgent. But it would also be nice to see some new institutions emerge out of the wreckage of the subprime adventure. Failed small banks and mortgage brokers could be turned into community development nonprofit, and cooperative institutions. As I suggested before, instead of foreclosing upon people who are behind in their mortgages, some public entity could acquire their houses and transform them into limited equity cooperatives. In such an arrangement, people could own their dwellings, but only sell them back to the co-op at a price reflecting improvements plus price inflation, but without any speculative gain. Occupants would continue to pay mortgage under such arrangements, but a smaller one, with the government picking up some of the write-off and banks absorbing some of it as well. This brings us to the next issue at hand, the housing problem itself. All the financial melodrama discussed I've just been discussing is a reflection of the fundamental underlying problem that people took out mortgages that they couldn't afford to buy houses that are now declining in value. All the Fed's gyrations cannot really resolve that fundamental problem, and it's very unlikely that much of anything that the government can do can change that very much either. As I pointed out before, the housing boom that took off in the mid-90s was totally unprecedented in U.S. economic history. According to Robert Shiller's very long-term index, the housing market has experienced many ups and downs over the years, but most of the downs have undone much of the ups, which left prices in 1990 only slightly higher after adjusting for inflation from what they were 100 years earlier. All this changed around 1996 when prices went vertical. They rose about 85% in real terms into their mid-2006 peak. They're now down about 13% from that peak. In recent housing cycles, prices have given back about half of the upswing's gains and lasted almost as long. That would suggest that we're now only about a quarter of the way through the down cycle, not, of course, that past performance is a guarantee of future results. Comparing house prices to household incomes also suggests there's a lot more to go. For a long time, the average house cost about 3 to 4 times the average household's income. During the bubble, that got up to almost 5 times average incomes. We've come off those peaks a bit, but there's still plenty more downside to go. There are two ways that prices could come back into whack with incomes, either by falling about 17% from here or going nowhere while incomes creep higher. And since the economy the next few years is likely to be pretty awful, creep is probably the accurate word. Assuming no change in house prices and slow growth in incomes of about 3%, not adjusting for inflation, house prices should reach the average ratio by mid-2009. To match the price-income ratio's recent low under the same assumptions would take till sometime in 2011. So either by time or price, we're not close to the end of all this. And what about the immediate economic consequences? The leading indicators, which forecast economic activity several months ahead, aren't looking so good. The Conference Board's venerable leading index is down now 5 months running, and its yearly rate of change is in the same neighborhood it was several months before the onset of the recessions of 1990 and 2001. It's nowhere near as bad as it was, however, in the run-up to the nasty recessions of 1974-75 and 81-82. A less well-known leading index produced by the Economic Cycles Research Institute is telling a similar story. So while many pundits are forecasting a deep recession ahead of us, that's not yet visible in the stats. Who knows, though? We may get there yet. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back with Jim Ledbetter.
When Karl Marx was a boy, he took a hard look around. He saw people were starving all over the place while others were painting the town. A public-spirited boy became a public-spirited man. So he worked very hard and he read everything until he came up with the plan. There'd be no exploitation, the worker or his kin. No discrimination, cause the color of your skin. No more private property, it would not be allowed. No one could rise too high, no one could sink too low. Or go under completely, that's something we all know. If Marx were living today, he'd be rolling around in his grave. And if I had him here in my mansion on the hill, I'd tell him a story that would give his old heart a chill. It's something that happened to me.
And that a bit of Randy Newman's song addressed to Karl Marx, The World Isn't Fair, and certainly indeed it isn't. And now we're joined in the studio by Jim Ledbetter, who is journalist, formerly with Time Europe and then Fortune.com, and now about to unleash a venture upon the world. But we've got him here because he's the editor of a collection of Karl Marx's journalism, which is just out from Penguin. Welcome, Jim.
Thanks, Doug.
So I think a lot of people don't know that Marx was a journalist. Tell us about his journalistic career.
It's true. Even people today who consider themselves knowledgeable about Marx, many of whom are in the academy, tend not to know of Marx's journalism for some reasons that we can discuss. But the fact is that Marx, who never really had a job, the closest thing he did to actual employment for pay was to write columns for newspapers, and principally for the New York Tribune for 11 years, 1851 to 1862. Over the course of that period, about 500 articles were published with Marx's name attached to them. Well, that were submitted by Marx, occasionally written by Engels, occasionally written by the two of them together. They were primarily written in English, and they're written at what would be today considered a rather long newspaper essay. But
they seem to go on for like 5 or 6 book pages.
Yeah, they can go on for upwards of 3,000 words. So they're quite long by today's standards, not out of whack with 19th century standards. And if you take these 500 works, just as if they were book length, they take up I believe it's 7.5 volumes of the collected works of Marx and Engels, which is 50 volumes, which is more than Das Kapital, which is more than the any book that was published by Marx when he was alive or after he died. And so one of the reasons why I did this collection of Marx's journalism is to try and push people a little bit to think about Marx in ways that he's not traditionally been thought of, that among the many categories in which you can put Karl Marx, one of them surely should be professional journalist. This is what he did to make money. This and sponging off Engels were his only actual sources of income.
His kind of journalism is not very recognizable to practitioners of journalism today, is it?
No, it isn't at all. And it's arguable whether it was recognizable to readers in the 19th century either, particularly Anglo-American readers. Marx did not really believe in what you might call sort of writing for the audience or dumbing his pieces down. He wrote strident polemics that were published in the Tribune. Sometimes I think reluctantly, sometimes against the wishes of the editors of that paper, although the editors of that paper were certainly, this is the New York Tribune, founded by Horace Greeley, were certainly among the most progressive American publishers at the time, probably the principal anti-slavery organ in the United States, for example. His style is Germanic and bombastic and very, very opinionated, which is not that surprising for anyone who's familiar with Marx's other writings, but it is a little surprising to see it in the context of what we think of as journalism. Having said that, they can be wonderful reads. They are at times, in part, I think, because he had to sort of struggle on deadline to deal with the world that was changing around him. He was compelled to, as it were, mold his theoretical construct for things, which we're familiar with in the book-length works, to the actual things that were going on in the world. And I think that that's a very compelling idea.
Well, actually, to anyone who's read Capital, the way he goes from like the reports on the factories and such, and quotes The Economist and
absolutely,
you know, leading bankers of the time and such. I mean, he was not an abstract theoretician,
although
he was good at abstract theory. But he would go from one world back to the other.
That's
very comfortably between them.
That's absolutely right. In fact, there are a few pieces that I've reproduced in this book, Dispatches from the New York Tribune, which read almost like sections of Capital. In fact, the semi-annual reports of factory workers that the British government sort of spewed out were a favorite source of his. I think there's one inspector, Leonard Horner, who's cited, I think, 13 times in Capital, and the same reports or different years of the same reports were the subject of his newspaper articles. So again, there's a mini school of Marxist theorists today who look at these newspaper articles as almost rough drafts for what would later become Capital. That's quite right.
And when he was writing these things for an American audience, he was not known as the radical political philosopher.
That's right, and that's another thing that's sort of difficult for us to perceive now. The notion of communism was not unknown in the United States in the middle of the 19th century, but it didn't have Marx's name attached to it. Communism, of course, as an idea, had been around for several decades, and ideas of collective ownership and production were very much in the air in certain circles, even in the United States. But again, the language barrier is a formidable one, and the book-length works for which Marx is today best known, the Manifesto and Capital and other works, were not translated into English until after his death. Therefore,
I was surprised to learn that about the Manifesto, because that seemed like a very, you know, in the moment polemical piece.
It is very surprising. There was an English translation published in a even then obscure British journal that quickly went out of business. In fact, I think it may have existed only to publish the Manifesto and sold, you know, 30 copies or something like that. And I think, you know, the British government was always spying on him when he lived in London. They probably had some sense of what he was writing in German. But I think for the American audience, the mass audience, the hundreds of thousands of people who read the New York Tribune in the 1850s, Marx's name had no other work attached to it except for the pieces that he did for that paper.
I'm speaking with Jim Ledbetter, who is the editor of Karl Marx Dispatches for the New York Tribune, Selected Journalism of Karl Marx, just out from Penguin Books, with a foreword by Francis Wien, who wrote a biography of Marx.
Yeah, who, if you haven't read his biography of Marx, I highly recommend it. It's very readable. It's very funny. It's sympathetic without being in any way uncritical, and it was a huge hit in Britain. I think a little less known here, but it's very much worth tracking down.
I have to admit, it's sitting on the shelf and I've never
read
it.
Really,
so now I'm encouraged.
It's a treat.
Well, tell us about some of the subjects that got Marx's blood moving.
Well, the great thing about delving into these is that it's a window onto the conflicts of the 19th century that literally formed Marx's worldview. One of the principal conflicts that he wrote about at the time was the Crimean War. Which was a dispute between England, Russia, and some other players over the dissolving Ottoman Empire, what big chunks of what now would be Turkey and some of the states nearby. And, you know, Marx's perspective on this was that the war was a disaster for England, whose democracy, at least on a theoretical level, he admired very much, but he was not particularly enamored of many of the governments of the time, in fact, any of the governments of the time. And he believed that, in essence, England had cut a secret deal with Russia. And a lot of those pieces were actually written by Engels, who was a formidable military historian. I think that the pieces that stood out to me the most are certainly the ones on India. Again, Marx was writing during the period of the most significant uprising in India in 1856, 1857, and saw in it the germs of what would eventually become what we would now call Indian independence. Marx had a very interesting view of India. He was not especially sympathetic to what today, I guess, you would call the multicultural point of view. He didn't have a lot of respect for the Hindu religion. He found it mind-numbing and world-negating. And so in a kind of classic Marxist dialectic, he saw the English occupation for all of its enslavement, for all of its moving India onto an opium-based economy. He saw in it the germs of progress, the building of railroads, for example, the shoring up of ports, the wholesale transformation of the Indian economy into something that we would now sort of call globalization. He saw that eventually those instruments would be used to throw off the English oppressor, if I can sort of lapse into Marxist jargon here. And those pieces are just fascinating, because I think for a lot of external observers at the time, the Indian uprising was an impudent moment at best. It was sort of dismissed by the British papers, by the British government. But it was really a crisis for the British Empire, one of several that he paid attention to. Another one that again takes us into an area that Marx is not well known for writing about was the Second Opium War.
Now, you point out in your introduction, I think, that Marx's denunciations of the British use of opium in China is on China more than in China, is almost kind of a level of moral outrage that one doesn't associate with his scientific socialism.
I think that's right. And I was really struck reading these pieces that so much of what motivated Marx in his journalism looks like, well, first of all, it looks like contemporary advocacy journalism. I mean, it is in not so much in terms of style, although slightly, but also in terms of sort of subject matter and let's call it muckraking impulse. That I think you could make an argument that Marx was the founder of what we today call alternative journalism or advocacy journalism. But also that like advocacy journalism, it relies for its persuasion on a certain moral argument. And you see that for Marx, the real evils that really brought out the sense of outrage in him were slavery, what he saw as enforced drug addiction, that is opium being grown in India for export to China. China had banned the use of opium, but the East India Company made sure that they found ways around those bans. And I guess the third would be the persistence of poverty, which was a much more real concern in the Western world for Marx than perhaps it is for us today. We tend to sort of think these days about poverty abroad less so than poverty right down the street. Of course, it exists here, but it doesn't exist in anywhere near the numbers or scales that it did in even, you know, relatively prosperous Britain in the 19th century. And so while I think it would be probably an exaggeration to call Marx a moralist in this context, I do think that there was a dovetailing with morality at the time that probably did hit a note with his readers.
I'm speaking with James Ledbetter, who is the editor of a collection of Marx's journalistic writings, Dispatches for the New York Tribune, Selected Journalism of Karl Marx, which is just out from Penguin Classics. What is that they call them? The books that matter. and this certainly does. I noticed there's one essay in there about the British aristocracy's attitude towards slavery.
Fantastic.
But I love that bit about the philanthropy of the aristocracy is always more directed towards suffering far away rather than close to home.
There are a couple of essays that just really stand out as gems of both style and analysis. In one case, the Duchess of Sutherland, at the time, this is the 1850s, had brought Harriet Beecher Stowe to England to give a speech against the horrible institution of slavery, and all of the right-thinking English society people, the aristocratic, you know, sort of went to this speech, and I'm sure applauded it. And Marx sort of looks at the land owned by the Duchess of Sutherland in Ireland and in Scotland, and how in the 18th century they just threw thousands of peasants off of their farming land to grow sheep for commerce for the wool that was the essence of the British manufacturing at the time, and basically let all of these peasants go fend for themselves. And this is the beginnings of what would later become the potato famine, and just that all of Britain would be concerned about morality, you know, 3,000 miles away in the United States, completely ignoring the things right in front of us is a classic. And then later, once the Civil War breaks out, again the British mentality was a masterpiece of deception as far as Marx was concerned. The support for the idea of unity, and it was just horrible that the North would choose to go to war against the South when the United States must remain united, was, in Marx's view, a thin veil for an obvious mercantile interest in cheap cotton. That the slave-based economy that produced cheap cotton for the British textiles manufacturers was critical to the underpinnings of the British economy of the time. Of course, they could never state it in those terms, so they would couch it in these moral terms that Marx just brilliantly rips apart in these essays. And again, there is a confluence between, I think, Marx's most perceptive analysis and his best writing. That he is rhetorically in touch with himself when he's most incisive.
And you also point out in your introduction, I believe, that Marx's conception of journalism didn't include sources the way it does today, which actually was a virtue.
Yes, I mean, this is a point that Murray Kempton made quite well in an essay in the New York Review in 1967. That Marx had no sources. That's not quite right. He had no official sources. He had a number of correspondents. People involved with the Working Men's Association, people involved in socialist circles on the continent. He would read their letters, which would have their own dispatches, and incorporate some of that into his columns and his other work. But he did not go and do a sit down with the Prime Minister. He did not hang around Parliament and try and curry favor with legislators or researchers or party officials.
Did not go to a barbecue on John McCain's ranch.
Exactly, and as a consequence, he was never spun in the contemporary lingo. I mean, he could not be bought. He could not be rented. He could not even really be reached. Keeping in mind that Marx's ability to travel was greatly restricted. He was not allowed into France or Germany after a certain point, and lived out his days in London, which was at best tolerant, but perhaps more accurately sort of just unaware that he was living there. But Kempton's point, and I think it's obvious to anyone who dives into these essays, is that that very distance and the reliance on his own wit, his own research, and his own analysis meant that his pieces could far transcend the sort of wispy commentary of the time.
All right, we're just about out of time, so you are launching a new web venture on Monday. Just in 15 seconds, what's that about?
A financial website being spun off of Slate.com to be called The Big Money. We're looking for a summer launch, and I'll be the editor of that, and it's a very exciting adventure, and I'm looking forward to it.
All right, so look for that, the summer launch. You start work on Monday, but
it's not
launching till the summer.
Correct.
Okay. All right, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Doug.
I've been speaking with Jim Ledbetter, who is the editor of a collection of Marxist journalism, dispatches for the New York Tribune, selected journalism of Karl Marx, just published by Penguin Books. And let's take a break for Station ID, and we'll be back.
Only two things scare me, and one is nuclear war.
What's the other?
Excuse me?
What's the other thing that scares you?
Hi, this is Jamie.
Hi, this is Sarah from Brand Van 3000, and you're listening to
WBAI 99.5 FM.
New York. See how relaxed you're getting?
Indeed.
And, we're back. This is indeed WBAI 99.5 on your FM dial and on the web at WBAI.org. My name is Doug Henwood. The show is Behind the News. And let's take a musical break and we'll be back.
Thank you.
we're back at a bit of Beethoven's Piano Sonata number 32, the second movement performed by Alfred Brendel. We're now joined in the studio by Noemi Prince, formerly an employee of Bear Stearns, a firm that has been much in the news in recent days, a journalist and now also a novelist. She just handed me a copy of a book written by her alter ego. Noemi, what's this all about?
It's called The Trail. It's a corporate political thriller about a secret and rather criminal group of people who are part of the SEC, believe it or not, under control of perhaps, the vice president, and a bunch of shady things that go down between Washington and Wall Street. But this time there's some, a little bit of drama and action and everything in it. It is fiction, after all.
And, of course, criminality and official circles would be totally fictional, right?
Totally fiction to think that the relationship between Washington and Wall Street could be anything but pure.
You know, I remember back during the 92 presidential campaign, I think it was, there's a piece in Barron's by Jonathan Quitney about George Bush the Elder and mysterious doings of the firm that he founded. He founded Zapata. And there's some mysterious stuff that happened, and by God, the records at the SEC had disappeared.
Huh.
And no one else ever picked that up. It was just in this Quitney article. Quitney had been writing for the Wall Street Journal, a very respectable business reporter who died at a young age. The proximity of the Bush family to nasty goings-on is really a very well-established thing, it seems. But anyway, so Bear Stearns. Tell us about Bear Stearns, Noemi. It disappeared this week, didn't it?
Bear Stearns underwent what I consider a sort of takeout by the Federal Reserve. It is called in much of the media a bailout, but in fact, what the Fed actually did was bail out the rest of the perception of how well they could contain the problems in the entire banking system by sort of selling Bear Stearns to J.P. Morgan at sort of a rock-bottom price, and then taking on $30 billion worth of the really bad, risky stuff that was on their books. So now the Fed has actually entered into the hedge fund business itself, and Bear Stearns employees are, out looking for work elsewhere.
My guess is that Morgan will cherry-pick some people that it wants and the rest are sent packing?
Yeah, I mean, there's different estimates, but depending on what the press has said, depending on talking to people inside. But you can assume about half the people will find some sort of work elsewhere, at least they think they will. It's a tough market, obviously. We saw today Citibank's contracting by a couple thousand people. Earnings continue to be down. The market continues to be imploding. So it's not the best environment to be finding a job, but certainly J.P. Morgan will cherry pick. Certainly headhunters around Wall Street are on the scene, and it's kind of like picking the sort of, it's like vultures at sort of an accident. Old firms that I've also been in connection with, like Goldman, are certainly interviewing their select choices of people at Bear.
I've been a little surprised, actually, that there haven't been more layoffs than we've seen so far. Is this just not happened yet and it's going to, or what's your understanding?
Well, I think there's going to be a lot of layoffs at J.P. Morgan as they do look through what they've just acquired, no matter how many pieces of it or portions of it they collect. I think the announcement by Citigroup is just a beginning. Lehman Brothers is supposed to be letting go people. Goldman continues to sort of cull quietly. They might use a different term, but basically, sort of getting rid of people as well. So there actually have been layoffs. They just haven't been as announced as the Citigroup one was this morning. But there's assumptions that anywhere between 10 to 15% of the Wall Street community will be sort of cut if things continue as they have throughout this year.
Which will, of course, have a very big impact on the New York City economy.
No, absolutely. I mean, it certainly has had an impact on housing here, as housing has been impacted elsewhere by so many other aspects. And obviously in New York there is kind of a bid for really expensive homes that have been fed by Wall Street, which will you know, have the effect of continuing to contract the housing.
And having had an experience just trying to sell your own place, it was not pleasant, was it?
Yeah, I wound up selling my place to a doctor instead of anyone from Wall Street because I figured by the time it would actually close that that might be a better bet.
Yeah, but the time was when people would have lined up around the block to pick up a place like that, and now it took, what, close to a year?
It was about a year on the market.
So Bear Stearns has a reputation as a maverick firm. What exactly does that mean?
Well, Bear was always, and I was there in the 90s, and it always had this reputation of being slightly less snotty and particular and white-shirted as sort of Goldman or Morgan Stanley or Lehman Brothers. You know, it didn't just go after the Ivy League analysts to fill their sort of programs of new recruits. They went to state schools like the one I went to look for people as well.
Sounds like what Drexel Burnham was in the 80s. As somebody said of Drexel Burnham in the 80s that it had the ugly guys and the fat girls or the other way around.
Well, there was a lot of that. You know, I had a lot of sort of the big guys from New Jersey and stuff running. Not that there's anything wrong with New Jersey, but you know, just running a lot of the departments.
As a child of New Jersey myself, I wouldn't tolerate it.
There's nothing wrong with that. But no, there was certainly a slightly looser group of people, loose in the terms of just perhaps more less couth than outwardly than some of the people at some of the other firms. And when I was in London, it was even sort of more considered, you know, the Wild West, even though, you know, it's technically east of here. But that, you know, you had much more of a situation where people went out for lunch. They came back, you know, after having a bunch of drinks. It wasn't just the European mentality. It was like Europe and sort of New York combined relative to the other firms that were in the center of the city of London that wouldn't dream of, you know, ever doing anything more than sending out, you know, secretary for a coffee or something and that kind of thing.
And so how did Bear get into such trouble?
Bear was one of the first firms to get involved in the CDO market, collateralized debt obligation market, which has now become a bit of a more known phrase than it was. But effectively, before subprime even existed as a topic in the media, though of course it was a topic, it was called predatory lending back in the day. But, you know, Bear started, and then so did a lot of other firms, to collect packages of emerging market bonds and high-yield bonds, which had been called junk bonds in Drexel Burnham's day and then became called high-yield bonds, which were really the same, just under a different name, and sort of packaging them and collecting them and then selling them off to investors in such a way that those investors would be guaranteed with slightly more risk a higher return on those types of securities. And then when everyone else started getting into the business, and that really was everyone, like banks and investment banks and hedge funds into that aspect, Bear started to look into subprime mortgages and other types of risky mortgage assets because it was very familiar with mortgage products. It kind of was known in the 90s as a mortgage firm in terms of its trading abilities and everything it did. And then it started with subprime, and then it started a bunch of credit hedge funds in the beginning of the millennium. And those became, they grew and grew and grew, and they basically became a component, and not even a large component of the subprime CDO market.
One of the first things that blew up when this all started was a Bear Stearns.
It was. It blew up in terms of being first. It was not that other values of CDOs on everybody else's book weren't also declining. What Bear had was the benefit of being first in that decline and being noticed first and being picked up by the media. And to a lot of extents, those funds that were started to go under in the summer was really what made the media pick up subprime as a topic and the housing market and all those connections and the connections to Wall Street. So Bear was certainly one of the first. It is by no means the only one. And the other problem with Bear is it acts as it's one of the biggest prime brokerage businesses on Wall Street, which means it basically acts as a facilitator to hedge funds to leverage their packages of whatever else they might own, whether it's subprime CDOs or any other types of kind of risky assets. So they kind of grease the wheels for that to go forward. So, you know, going back to why the Fed came in and took them down, basically they wanted to contain the possibility of more funds blowing up really spectacularly, because all of the CDOs that are out there that are collateralized by these risky assets are worth, you know, very, very little to nothing, and there is no bid for them. So this isn't something that won't and hasn't been spreading across the books of Wall Street.
Now, are these assets that are underlying a lot of these complex securities fundamentally worthless, or is this it's just that everybody thinks they're worthless and becomes self-fulfilling?
There's two things. I mean, on the one hand, subprime in general has certainly not performed well historically. But that said, the securities themselves aren't performing for and have been deteriorating for a lot of other reasons beyond subprime lent homes going down in value or being foreclosed upon or being defaulted upon. There's the aspect of these loans were combined with better loans. They were packaged and insured by AAA insurers that effectively said, well, no matter what happens to these riskier loans, the asset that they are a part of will continue to pay off. And that didn't happen. What happened was these risky assets, a portion of them stopped performing. So one slice of the security of which they were a part became worth nothing. And then the second slice that was sitting on that nothing slice became the next slice to be worth nothing, and so forth. It was almost like each of the slices of subprime loans cushioned the fall of the one above it in these multi-layered securities. And
sort of like the fall of the World Trade Center, just floor by floor.
If the bottom falls, the next level becomes the bottom, and then that falls, and then there is no bid in the market for a number of reasons. A, because the security has less value as a collection of loans. The loans have less value because there's nowhere else to put them. You can't recreate them into another security of these same loans because there is no market for them. So what happens is they become completely worthless in terms of being created into a security that Wall Street is leveraging and trading and making a lot of, at one point, making a lot of money off of. So it is a kind of castle falling, on its own foundation type of scenario.
I'm speaking with Naomi Prinz, who a former investment banker, formerly one time at Bear Stearns, who's now a journalist, author of Jacked, and also of Other People's Money, and also a novel on her alter ego, Natalia Prentice, The Trail. And The Trail is available at Amazon, Amazon.com, with a very stunning cover picture, I should say.
Thank you.
I haven't had a chance to look at it yet. So I had a suspicion that there are certainly hints of this in the press, that there are a lot of people who didn't like Bear Stearns and weren't all that sad to see it go. Did that motivate any of the Fed's rather punitive rescue operation at all?
Well, Bear Stearns had far less ties to Washington than a lot of the other firms on Wall Street. And generally, they were less kind of connected for that same sort of maverick reason. They didn't have the same sort of smooth, you know, seamless types of relationships at the senior level that a lot of the other firms like Goldman, who, you know, continues to have Treasury secretaries come from its halls. So it didn't have those. As a matter of fact, if you look at, you know, where we are obviously in an election year, if you look at the political, even campaign contributions that go into Washington, Bear Stearns doesn't and has never made any of the top lists of what goes in there. So it didn't have a lot of friends politically. It certainly had no friend in the Treasury Secretary, who had been the CEO of one of its rival firms. So, you know, you kind of add all that together, and if you're going to take a firm out and make a statement and pretend you're in control of a situation so that you don't have to actually talk about why the entire market is systemically screwed up, it's a good one to prey upon.
And of course, Baird did not participate in the 1998 bailout of long-term capital management, which many other Wall Street firms did, so I have to wonder if there was also a little revenge involved in that.
No, absolutely. And the money that, whether it was the $30 billion that the Fed, you know, bought or is buying some of Bear Stearns's securities on, again, entering their own hedge fund component of the business, it's there is some of that. They could have chosen a bailout, which again is how a lot of the media portrays it, but they didn't choose a bailout. They chose a takeout.
Yeah, the shareholders of Bear Stearns are largely wiped out. So, and many people who work there, their life savings are wiped out. So this is not a scot-free deal for the people who are tied to Bear Stearns.
No, and it's a way. If you're taking out or selling stock at $2 a share, you're assuring most of the people, and it's not just the people at the top. You know, if Jimmy Kane, you know, the former leader, goes from a net worth of $1 billion to, you know, I don't know, 50 million or whatever, I mean, he'll be okay. He's not going to work at Walmart to, you know, make up for it. But, you know, if you're in much of the rest of the firm, it is a large component of certainly your retirement, and also a lot of what you've received over the years. I mean, just like Enron, Bear, and many places in corporate America still and on Wall Street, if not require, sort of make it apparent that it's important to take the optimal amount of compensation or retirement funds or whatever in the firm's stock. I mean, it is still seen, even after what we saw happen to all the Enron employees, not all of whom were Ken Lay, you know, that has not changed.
So are there more of these in the future, or is this the event that marks the beginning of the end of all this, do you think?
There's about $2 trillion worth of collateralized debt obligations floating around the world. And we've only seen this takedown of one of the firms that was involved and $120 billion of write-downs on Wall Street. And there is still no bid for these securities. So if you take all those three things together, it's not likely this is stopped. I mean, the only thing that has happened, and Hank Paulson did this last year when he said the subprime, in the summer, he thought the subprime problem was contained, you know, like 8 or 9 months ago. And obviously that, you know, wasn't true.
We don't know how big the container is.
Depends on your perspective, but you know, I do believe. I mean, whether it's a big firm, that there's certainly going to be smaller firms that I think are going to have to actually declare bankruptcy or actually talk about takeovers with some of the bigger firms. But also, there's still a lot of risk out there, and there's still a lot of securities that have not yet been marked, I think, properly or at their full devaluation, because there are no actual rules for that kind of thing that are sitting on the books of a lot of Wall Street and globally.
Yeah, there's no market for a lot of this stuff, so nobody has remotely any idea what it's actually worth. It's just all these invented values in people's heads. The people who put these CDOs together, did they know they were wrapping a lot of garbage in with in the package, or was this just all done in good faith?
No, you know you're wrapping in garbage. Again, the first CDOs started with non-performing or low-performing emerging market bonds, and not just at Bear, that was one of the first places, but throughout the financial community, and then with junk bonds. The difference was, at the time, you knew if you were buying a collection of junk bonds, it was kind of known that,
all,
you know,
right?
Even if it's called high yield, you knew what it was. And with subprime and alt A and all these different components that were part of CDOs that were just pieces of various types of mortgage products, you, of course, you know they're risky. The whole reason they have more value to them, that they carry more interest into the package, into the CDO, is because they are risky. If they were not risky, they would not be so attractive as they were at the time to sell everywhere and to leverage everywhere. And so you absolutely knew they were risky. The problem was that when they were sold and when they were modeled, the assumptions for their risk, though they existed, were lower than what turned out to be the risk. So there was definitely a known concept of risk involved. If you didn't have risk, you wouldn't have had return. It's kind of an old, and the more risk you're taking, the more return you can say that you'll get, possibly on the quote upside. But the problem was that
everybody likes to talk about risk, but nobody wants to actually assume it.
Well, and that's the whole point of these CDOs. The idea is that the only people that were assuming risk in these CDOs was the group of investors called the equity investors who bought that bottom layer. And they knew that they were taking a risk, and the firms that were trying to sell equity pieces to these players kind of said there was a risk and modeled some stuff around the risk. But a lot of these investors chose to take that risk. And what happened was when the risk became higher than what they thought they were bargaining for, they found they couldn't, they couldn't sell back the pieces that they had bought, and they weren't getting money on them, and they just basically became worthless, which is really what's happened in the last year or two. But they knew that they were taking the risk.
And now let's look forward, as we do always in the last couple of minutes of this sort of thing. I and many others have been saying that we need to re-regulate the system very badly. And I was actually talking to a friend of mine the other day who works on financial issues for a major union, guy with very good politics, very sophisticated fellow. And he says, well, he doesn't think you can do that because the computers are just too fast and there are too many ways to go offshore, and it's really just nearly impossible to re-regulate finances that presently exist. Is that true, do you think?
You can regulate if there was a political will to do so, which there hasn't been. You can regulate the amount of leverage a bank system takes on. You can regulate the type of transparency and the risk measurements that they use to value the securities that they create. You can regulate how much they borrow and how much they have at any time against these securities. You can actually require documentation. It's not impossible to regulate some of this stuff. If you look at Morgan Stanley just this week, they had their earnings announcement, and their price per share, earnings per share, was down like 42%. And they in turn said they were actually going to deleverage their balance sheet to, I don't know, 27% from 30-something percent. And the people who would say, you know, like a Paulson or, say, Bush, that that's the market taking care of itself, are actually could take a step further and try to use certain measures like that to legislatively regulate. There were a number of acts that did not pass in Congress in 2003 and in 2004 even to try and get more regulation in some of the lending practices. And alternatively, in 93 and 94, and leading up to the repeal of Glass-Steagall, which deregulated much of banking, there were acts that, one of which was an abolition of the original Truth in Lending Act of 68, that in 94 said we have to get rid of all these regulation measures in lending because it's slowing the process down.
Well, that's the very idea, though, isn't it? As if that were something rather wrong.
As if that were bad, which obviously it has turned out to be.
Well, as Bob Fitch says, vulgar Marxism explains 90% of what goes on in the world. And I think in this case, the fact that Congress people's campaign contributions come in very large part from people on Wall Street, they're not about to write anything unless there's enormous popular pressure to make them do so.
Right.
All right. Well, we're out of time. Thank you for joining us, Naomi Prinz.
Thank
Naomi
you.
Is... once worked at Bear Stearns before she went straight, and now is a journalist, author of Jacked, of Other People's Money, and now under the nom de plume of Natalia Prentice of The Trail, which is available on Amazon.com. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I will be back next week, and let's go out with this from the new album by Stephen Malkmus. This is a bit of Hopscotch Willie from the album Real Emotional Trash. Till next week. Bye.